application.
So we just start.
Okay, so this talk is about the backend. It's intended for people who want to change code in the backend, but also for guys who want to know how to do things. And to see when the scheduler is not running, so how to restart and what's the internal process on the backend. Okay, that's the outline of the talk. First, I'm going to talk a bit about data management, how your data is actually stored on disk, and the on disk are your project packages, of course, and but also the source repository, which holds every source file you uploaded in your life to build service. And then I continue to talk a bit about the server framework. It's actually a freshly written backend code. We use Perl as a programming language, and because it has some unique features, we had to do it from scratch, like support for long-running jobs and so forth. I'll come to that later on. And then, as a third point, I'm talking about how the package building process works. That is the kind of flow between the components of the backend. There's the scheduler, there's the source server and the repository server, and there's the build client and also the dispatcher process. And the automatic rebuild triggering would be an interesting topic as well, but as the time is pretty rare here, we have just have half an hour for talk, I fear we don't want. We'll have to skip that one next time then. Here we go. So let's start with the backend basics. This slide is probably nothing, contains nothing new to you, it's just fresh up on the old, the basic topics. Here we have three projects on the slide. There's a KDE project, there's the OpenSUSE 10.2 project, and then Apache project. And the project contains packages for the KDE 4 project. It's the KDE Lips package, the KDE Toys package, and so on. But it also contains repositories. So packages are where sources get stored, and repositories are is where the build packages get stored. And then you can have also multiple repositories, like for building, again, with OpenSUSE 4 and OpenSUSE 10.2. Then you have an OpenSUSE 10.2 repository, which you want to build to Fedora. For Fedora, you have a Fedora repository, and of course, yes, you can have as many packages as you like. You can also have as many repositories as you like. And the OpenSUSE 10.2 project here has only one repository, but no packages. It's because we upload the RPMs directly into the repository, and Apache has a couple of packages again. So, I almost pressed the wrong key. As I said, the project consists normally of a project name, of course, and then we have the metadata, that's the title of the project, and the longer description, and what two repositories should we build the project against. And then we have some build configuration. This is normally for projects like the OpenSUSE project, where we have to specify how to set up the complete build environment. This is which packages to install, if nothing specified. We need a compiler, obviously, and the glibc. And it also contains the compile options, the RPM options, and the RPM macros. So if this is where you would specify the prefix should be this as a macro. And of course, the project contains multiple packages. And here's how it's stored. It's actually pretty straightforward. We have a project directory, and in this case, the project name is home, colon, msure, and that's me. And then if the project metadata, just simple as an XML file, and it's just stored in with a .xml appended. And then we have the configuration. This is the second part here. Build configuration, prefixes, compiler options, and macros, and so on. And this is stored right next to the XML configuration. And to store the packages, we just create a directory there as well, and append.pkg to the project name. And this directory will contain all the packages later on. Click down. So, packages. Packages have, of course, the package name, that's KDE Lips and so on, for example. Then we have also metadata. For packages, it's basically at the moment just the title and the long description and also some information if it's disabled or not. That's basically all we have in the package for now, but it might have also contain some rating stuff and so on later. And then we have the revision log. This is basically the check-in history later on. We store, as I said, the packages is stored in the directory in the project. And here is the metadata. The package is screen metadata example. We have the screen.xml metadata, which holds the summary and so on. And we have the revision log, it's just screen.ref. And the revision log is just a simple text file that contains lines like this. First, it starts with the revision number. This is the revision 12. If it's the last line in the log, then this is the current source. As then revision 12. And then you have the release number. This is the first part the package gets as a release when it's built. It's because our release number scheme is check-in release dot rebuild counter. So the build service always creates packages which consist of this check-in release dot release the rebuild counter. The check-in release would be 76 in that example. And then you see this MD5 sum. This is actually the source identifier which specifies which source files to use. And the next slides will contain more about that one. Then we have a version and some check-in information like which user did the check-in and when the check-in was done. Just a simple timestamp. Okay, so let's talk a bit about the source repository. The source repository needs to have a couple of interesting features. It needs to, of course, to allow the backend to retrieve data. But as an added bonus, it also allows the users to retrieve old versions of data. So nothing is ever deleted. You can always check out an old revision again or do a source diff between your revision 1 and your current revision and so on. So this is quite interesting. And the next design goal was that switching to the new source revision had to be atomic, so that if you do a check-in and the check-in consists of a new tarball and a new spec file, you want to switch to this new source revision in an atomic way, so it's just not first the tarball that is changed and then build started to change tarball and then the spec file is later on also replaced. So it should be that the upload is atomic to the backend, so that no builds get started with inconsistent data. And then, as a third design goal, it should not contain much disk space. So identical files should be stored just once because disk space is rare, especially if everybody can access the service and upload their sources. We really don't want 20 kernel sources. Tables on the build service, which is virtually identical, but stored in different files, would make no sense. To implement that, this implementation is pretty easy too. We just, as a trick, prepend each file name with the MD5 sum of the content of the file. So that when the file has a different content, it gets a different file name. So that's why we can always retrieve the old file name, because the old file name is different content and it's still on disk and doesn't get deleted. We don't ever delete files. And for this revision identifier, this is the long MD5 sum you had on the slide before. We just use the MD5 sum over the MD5 sum of your source directory. So it's kind of meta MD5 sum. Next slide will make it more clear. And as I said, nothing gets deleted, just new files are added, so they can always retrieve old files. So how does this MD5 sum scheme work? As an example, again, the screen package. The screen package consists of four files. These are the diff, because for some local tweaks, of course, and the Debian rule stuff. Then we have the DC file from Debian builds, spec file for RPM-based builds, and the pristine tarballs for the build. And these four files have the following MD5 sum. So if I run MD5 sum from the start, on the four files, I get this output. And if I now build an MD5 sum over this MD5 sum file, I get this MD5 sum, meter MD5 sum, and this is actually also the source identifier in the slides, two slides I had before here. And it's stored like, just like this. So we just replace the two spaces from the MD5 sum file with a dash, and then we have the on-disk file name. So we have the source prefetch contains all the source repository stuff, and then we have the screen package, and then MD5 sum minus the file name. And of, we have to, of course, we have to store the MD5 sum of the meter file of the MD5 sum file as well, so they can retrieve files later on. I'll show you how that works. There is a task at hand. We need the spec file for the build. We have this source revision and this spec, that package. So we enter that directory here. We read our MD5 sum file, you know which one, because we have the MD5 sum we provided to build. And then we check the MD5 sum file we read for the screen spec file, get another MD5 sum, and with that MD5 sum we can access the file. And this is how this, a single MD5 sum is enough to identify a complete set of files we need for building. Okay, so much for data storage on disk. Let's talk a bit about this framework. As I said, it's written in Perl. It was written on Scratch because it has some nice features like file and CPIO streaming. So it can on the fly assemble and reassemble CPIO files. It has automatic parameter type checking, so that if the send a request to a process and the request contains a project ID or a project name or a package name, then the server automatically checks if the ID is the name is well formed, that is, it mustn't contain a slash and so on. So we have some rules about project and package names, and the server automatically enforces the rules. It's built in the way that it forks a new process for every request, but as a unique feature, some requests can take a long time, and these can be passed by the code to a special process that works with those long-lasting processes. The idea behind that is we want to use that for the AJAX requests. So you can send a request to the server, give me the state of my project. So the server tells you the current state is this and this, and there's a state identifier, which is actually also MD5 sum. If the state identifier is that, and then you can send another request to the server, give me the state again, but only when it's different from that state. And so the request blocks and just only returns when something in the state has changed. And this is a long-running request, and we can't do that when we fork a new process for every request. So what we do is that the fork process passes the request along to this other process, special process, via a Unix domain socket, and it uses file descriptor parsing to pass the socket onto this special process. And this process collects all those long-running requests, and if the load on that process is too high, it can just say to the requester, sorry, my load is too high, call me back in 5 minutes or so. Okay, or 1 minute probably. So with that idea, we hope to achieve a very nice AJAX updates on the server. Unfortunately, the neither OS scene nor the web client we have now loses the scheme, but we hope to switch to it in the future. Now, here is a simple example how to get the source listing from the data flow. We have the client here, OSC client, which does the following things to the API. This is the front end that Tony has talked about in the talk before. With that URL here to the right, you can access the package directory. And the API checks if the permissions are sufficient. If yes, it passes it right on to the source server. It's a part. This is part of the backend. The backend then takes this URL, goes to the dispatch table, and checks if there's a function for this URL. And if it finds a function, then it calls the function, and the function does all the job when retrieving the data from the source repository and sends the data back to the API. And the dispatch table looks like the following. It's just here. The request starts with source, then comes a project, then a package, and an optional revision. And the function would be get files in this example. So if the backend receives the source repository receives a URL that matches this layout, it just calls the function. The function is to get files. This is a little Perl code. I hope you all know a bit about Perl. And here you see it gets the project ID and the package project name and package name as argument. That's because there was a dollar here. It's the thing of this dispatch function. And then it just uses this getref function here, which just opens the revision file on disk and reads and parses the line of the revision, or if no revision is specified, if the CGI hash is empty, it just uses the last line, gets the source MD5, and then it accesses the function here, this lsrep, which is list repository, which just goes into the repository and does the three steps I had. Couple of slides before. Then you get a list of files here, and then you just do some Perl magic to create the answer, and this return statement is everything that you needed to send the answer back, and the framework automatically converts the answer from the Perl data structure back into XML. Speaking about this conversion, it uses the a CPAN XML.structured module. Here's how it works. It's a little bit, do you know XML simple? It's a simple conversion between the Perl data and XML. And this is a bit like XML simple, but the difference is that you can specify exactly what the structure of your data structure, Perl data structure is, so that you can have defined argument ordering, attribute ordering, and element ordering, and so on. So here you have a directory consists of a name, a revision, and entries. And the entries, this is a list of elements, and the entry looks like this. It contains a name and the size. So if you pass it on with the XML out function, it just creates the XML data from the Perl data structure. So the Perl data structure is just an array with hashes and gets converted to the XML output you see to the right. And of course, there's also an XML in function, which is just a reverse way, so that when new metadata is passed to the backend from the build client, it can parse it and do the Perl stuff. Now, how does the build work? Now we have all the source stored in the backend, and everything is ready to build a package. And here's everything that is involved with the building packages in the backend. We have the source server, it contains the sources. We have the repository server, which provides access to repositories. We have scheduler for the architectures. We have a job queue. The queue jobs builds, and then we have a job dispatcher which takes looks at the job queue, looks if we have any jobs that need building, and assigns those jobs to the building clients. Here's what happens. So, scheduler gets started, scheduler does a get project get project and package data. The source server goes to all the project and packages on this and returns data of the metadata of every project and every package. It also selects the newest version, source revision of every package it finds. This is the last check-in. And looks what the spec and DSC file to build with, just scans the directory. If there's a spec file in it, or if multiple spec files are in it, which to use. If it's a Debian packet, a Debian repository, we search for DSC packet files. It parses the spec or DSC files and returns the package dependencies. So that's all in the ProPack structure here. So the scheduler gets a list of project, packages, and package dependencies. Then the scheduler reads the repository data for every project it has to build for. It directly accesses the repository on this because the scheduler is the instance that changes the repository, so it's okay for the scheduler to do direct reads on the repository. It doesn't need to go through to the repository itself because it's the entity that changes it. So there's no race involved. The scheduler reads it right from this and it's faster. So what it does, it searches the repository and returns every binary package and every provides and required of this package, so that then at the next step it takes the dependencies it read from the source server, it knows what it provides and requires from the repositories, and then it can expand this dependency list. So when the build requires contains whatever a KDE base, and KDE base needs KDE libs for working, to get automatically also get KDE libs installed. But this is the package expansion step. This is also where you can get these nice expansion errors you probably know if you have already built packages in a build service. Then it does the tree sort on the dependencies, so that the packages are looked at in the correct order. First the packages that don't depend on anything, then the afterwards packages that have simple dependencies to the packages in front and so on, so that it first builds packages with no dependencies and then package building on top of those old packages later on. Then it checks if a package needs to get rebuilt, and if it gets rebuilt and it doesn't depend on a package that is also just rebuilding, because it would make no sense if to build it then. So if another package blocks this build, it just adds the build to the job queue. The job dispatcher to the right here scans periodically to the job queue and looks for unassigned jobs. And if it finds an unassigned job and if it has idle build clients, it just uses the build request and the build client to push the job to the build client. And the job consists of just a bit of XML data which contains all packages it needs to install and the source identifier to get the sources. The build client itself then uses get sources, get config to get the sources of the build, and get the config, that is the macro files and the build options, so the optimization level and so on. Then it uses the get binaries call on the repository server to get all the package binaries, that is the compiler and the libraries. And then if it has all that, it's ready for building. It sets up the Xen environment and runs Xen and the standard SUSE build.rpm to just do the build. After the build is done, hopefully everything went well and we have some new binary packages. It uses the put job on the request on the repository server to go back to send the binaries and the log file back into the repository. Actually, the repository server just stores in temporary space because, as I said, the scheduler is the one entity that changes the repository. So the repository server just stores it on disk and then says, scheduler, we have some new binary packages, please do your thing and put them into the repository. Yeah, and then the scheduler copies the build packages into the repository and then we are through, and then just looks at the next package and so on after. And if nothing is to build, if the project has finished building, it creates all the external repositories and does the async of the build packages to the outside.
And what happens if the build is not successful?
When the build is not successful, it just sends log file back so that you can access the failure later on. And no binary packages, of course, are then put. But it doesn't delete the old packages from the repository. It just does a log file on disk so they can retrieve the log file.
Do you make you only make the log file available for the package maintenance? You don't make the system a snapshot of the system
no,
state?
No, that would okay. take much too much disk space. Would be not very very convenient for the user, but just that's why you have this OSC build where you can redo the build on the local host and then it stays.
And do you have any kind of synchronization between different architecture? Meaning if the build is successful for one and fails for the other, do you have any kind of specific handling?
Specific
if the build is successful for one architecture and not for the others?
No, it's no synchronization up to now.
Okay.
But I'm thinking about adding that too because sometimes it's nice that both architectures are pretty well out or none. So, but the current implementation just syncs one architecture out and that's about it. How are we in the time? Thanks, Eric. So, this is basic. So we talked about the layout of the backend, and here are some couple of slides about scalability. Because if for your local build instance, it's probably okay to run everything on one host. But if we want to really open the build service and have thousands of projects with hundreds of different build targets, then we must think about scalability as well. Simplest configurations here put everything on one host. So we have this web server and dispatcher, we have the schedulers, the source server, and the lurkers. Simplest approach for scalability is, of course, put the worker on a different host, or put lots of workers on different hosts so that packaging is building is a bit faster. This is the way we build.openstreetMap is currently set up. So we have one host with the repository server, source server, and the schedulers, and a couple of workers. But we can do more for scalability. We can put the source server on a different host. Every communication is done via HTTP, so it's no big deal to just move it to a different host and reduce the load. And then, as a last step, if we think it's really good time, we can also partition the repositories. So maybe you have one host which holds all the Debian repositories and does the Debian builds, and we have another host which holds the RPM-based builds. And you see here, we have to run schedules on this. And this host is valid. So every host must contain at least one repository server to access the repositories and schedulers for all architectures that are in that repository. Okay, so we are about 10 minutes left. I can either switch to the question and answers section or try to talk about rebuild triggering if it's an interesting topic to you. So what do you prefer?
Just a little question.
Yeah.
How do you use machines with multiple CPUs? Do you have multiple workers on them or do the workers themselves use the CPUs?
I should have put it on the slide. You just run multiple workers on it. So it's no big deal. You just on one host, you start for a worker for every CPU, or even you can also do overcommit if you have a fast IO subsystem, then maybe you want to run multiple workers in parallel, even if you have just one CPU. Okay, then let's go for the rebuild trigger. So how does the rebuild program work? This is actually a bit complicated. A naive implementation would just look at changed binaries. So if I have the screen package, and the screen package needs glibseed for building, and if there's a new glibseed package, then just we have to just rebuild screen as well. But this works good for some quite couple of packages, but it really breaks if we have dependency cycles. So here's an example. We have three packages as a cycle. It's this current cycle from 10.1, I think. We have the GNOME keyring package that has casa devil in the build requires line. So we need to build casa first. Casa itself needs gtk minus sharp for building. And gtk minus sharp has a build requires of gtkhtml2 devil, which in turn depends on the gtkhtml2 package, which also has a requires on the GNOME keyring library, which of course comes from the GNOME keyring package. So we need this package to build that one, gtkscar needs Kaiser, and GNOME keyring needs gtkscar sharp, so we have a classic cycle. So if you just use binary packages for the triggering, you would have an endless loop. Because after we are finished with GNOME keyring, we detect that we need to build gtk sharp again. Then the build continues on and on and on. So our solution to that is look at the source identifiers, because sources don't change in the when a package gets rebuilt. So we finish after all packages are built with the current sources. So this is an end to the cycle. We don't have endless loops. And what we do is we track the source changes and we cut the cycles off. How does that work? To make that work, we need a meta file, dependency meta file. It basically consists of all packages used for building. So here's an example, the Kaiser package. On the level 0, it contains its own source identifier. On level 1, it contains all packages needed for building. This is now example, it needed JTK minus sharp for building. On level 2, we have all the packages needed to build the packages in level 1. So we have here the GNOME keyring package. And you can see in this line from the meta file, GTK sharp, GNOME keyring, JTK sharp needed GNOME keyring, and this is in that file, we needed to build Kaiser.
Listen. So for source files, not for source package themselves.
No, this is the source identifier of the package sources. So this is not a file, this is not an MD5 sum of a file, but only of a group of files.
If you just rebuild a package and build the dates, they change to the sum, the MDS and sum of the package source, they change, and then with the contents, you don't. Meaning you're tracking sources, right?
You're tracking this track source changes.
Okay. But how do you then you infer that all source and dependencies? How do you track patching?
All patches are the part of the source.
Okay.
So maybe this is probably the question. We have this is the MD5 sum over the MD5 sum over the directory. So it contains the pristine source and all the patches and the spec file as well. So if you change the spec file, then identify it, we change as well. And
right, so if you just change the release number, because it's, I don't know how you handle.
If you just change the release number, it has to get rebuilt because the release number is different. So if you change something in spec file, you have to rebuild the package.
Okay. It means you suppose that you may rebuild the package without changing it as. Release number?
Sorry?
You mean that changing the specs file means changing the sum, the innocent sum, the identity, right? My point is, do you suppose that sometimes you rebuild your package without updating as release number?
This is actually the MD5 software, the source repository, not really the spec file which is really used for build, because they have been change the release number with every rebuild we do, because we prepend the dot rebuild counter to the release number. So this changes exactly if you use the web client or OSC to change something in the source tree. This is the only way this MD5 source identifier.
The source tree, so the spec file is a part of the source tree.
Yeah, so okay. If you use the web interface or OSC to change the release number or just change a comment or something in the spec file, this will trigger a rebuild. So then we have this meter file, and this is, we construct this meter file, and this is actually all there is to rebuild triggering mode, because the scheduler can construct the version of the scheduler, it sees that's the version that we want to have, and then there's this backend also stores the meter file used for the last build with the last build. So it just compares the actual meter file with the nominal meter file content. If there's a difference in this meter file, then the scheduler knows we have to rebuild. So if you run your build server at home on your host, and there are some interesting meter files, find some meter files, you know what's in it. It just consists of MD5 sums and package names. Okay, great. Let's conclude this talk. So I talked about data storage, how project and package metadata is stored on XML files, and the source repository is used to store all the other files in an efficient way. So you can retrieve old versions, you have atomic switches to new source revisions. And you, then I told you about the server framework used, the dispatcher, and that it's very, very easy to add new functions to the repository. So if you need the source server, so you can just give me a function which just needs some functionality for your own build service, it's very easy to add, it's just a couple of lines of code. Then I talked about package building, the complete build process, how the comes goes from the scheduler to the dispatcher and to the build client, back to the repository server, and then back into the scheduler. This is the great build cycle. And then all data is transferred via HTTP. So no NFS is used, which is a good thing, because in the internal system we had in OpenSUSE we used NFS, and it's really you get lots of problems with NFS, especially if you have old clients. And last thing we did was we talked a bit about rebuild triggering, how the rebuild triggering is done in the scheduler. Okay, thank you very much. Further questions?
So does it handle any kind of bootstrapping? For example, if you had one package which you can't build until you've built one of the build requires, does it handle any kind of bootstrapping?
Bootstrapping, well, you can do the bootstrapping in two ways. Either you have another project which contains the old version you need for bootstrapping, or you can upload binary packages, which currently doesn't work through the API layer because the doesn't support it, but the backend actually has upload functionality hooks. So you can write your own little upload script which just pushes the binary packages into the backend. But bootstrapping is really a hard issue, because you just, for some reason, you lose one binary package and all your build breaks. So it's not nice. Any more questions?
About the change writing strategy for the trade lane. You seem to build a strategy around sort change, but a sort change isn't supposed to mandatorily translate into a binary interface change. Actually, libraries and so on are supposed to explicitly advertise their binary interface version in some way that RPM usually encode in some form of dependency. You can use dependency tracking.
With that source scheme, you get lots of rebuilds which result in binary packages, a bytewise identical, maybe with just a timestamp is changed or so. So, but on the other hand, it maybe the all the dependencies stay the same, but there was a bug fix in the source and so on.
Why is safer strategy?
This is safe, but needs lots of build power.
And how you do? Will you identify dependencies that needs some form of work and develop recompilation? For instance, a dependency on a Perl library. There is no use recompiling your package just because another Perl library depends on has been changed. You have to identify native kind of dependency or real dependency.
Maybe yes. But this actually works quite well. We have this kind of scheme in SUSE for 10 years or so now. And it's really doing its job. Get lots of
those rebuilds, but... Meaning you are actually using it already?
We use this for years.
The automatic rebuilds?
Yeah, sure. And the build server also uses it currently. So everything on this slide is
okay. And you always explicitly raise your own rebuild when you're rebuilding your package?
We have the SUSE packages we ship, the SUSE CDs don't have this .rebuild count. They get rebuilt, but there's no rebuild count in the release numbers, you don't have a different rebuild release number. But
okay. The package has changed. Right? Okay.
Of course, normally if there's a software update, we put out only the packages that we need to give to. So the customer, of course, not gets all the rebuild packages. But internally, we have lots of rebuilds. So if we have agility change, we do complete distribution rebuild.
It's part of our training process, basically, because if you don't do this, the situation can appear that you want to release an update for any package. Later the cycle, and then suddenly you can't compile it anymore because someone, it's a real problem in some other.
You're screwed if you do, you're screwed if you don't. Just right away, because when something else changes and when we build the package only then, and then we find out that this thing is broken, then we don't know if it's the change in the package which was just changed, or it was maybe changed we did a couple of weeks ago.